You are listening to a very special episode of Screenfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. This week, we are not covering a film per se, but a whole plethora of them, because we are going to be talking about the 2017 Pomegranate Film Festival here in Toronto. We're so excited to have back Peter Adorian. Peter is a friend of the show, and he's heavily involved in the Pom Festival. And we will also have an interview with one of the directors of the films this year, Hike Matavosian. We get to cover a wide range of topics, from the spirituality of film to our sensitivity to violence. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Welcome to Screenfish Radio. We are very excited this week to have a special episode as we are going to talk about the Pomegranate Film Festival here in Toronto. The POM Festival runs every November and has been running for, I think, about 12 years. And one of the key people involved in bringing it to you is friend to the show, Peter Adorian. So welcome back, Peter. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. I guess with the festival now in the background of my life, I can do other things like be on a podcast. It takes a lot of work to put these things together, but I love talking about it in the aftermath. So thanks for giving me a platform to talk about what I love doing.
Oh, I do what I can, Pete, especially since no one listens to this anyway. Pete, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Pom Fest?
So the Pomegranate Film Festival, as you mentioned, is just wrapped up its 12th annual screening or selection of screenings. We are an Armenian film festival, Armenia being a country in the Middle East where we all come from. All of us, in fact. It's the cradle of civilization.
So I'm from Armenia, too?
That's right. That's right.
Wow. And so,
see, this is why everybody can get involved in the Pomegranate Film Festival.
What are the limits to the festival, though? Because you say it's an Armenian film festival, but
we screen films that have some connection to Armenians or were made by Armenians. So that would include everything from fictional accounts taking place with Armenian characters or in Armenia, or documentaries about Armenians in the diaspora, or about, I guess, big sort of culturally significant events like the Armenian genocide that happened in 1915. And we've also had a number of, I guess, what you would call kind of films that have nothing to do with Armenians or Armenia, but that are made by Armenians. Hmm. And so we show those types of films. It is a very much a local film festival in that sense, where we're kind of doing this in a community for our community. But that said, anybody could attend the festival. We're very happy to have non-Armenians enjoying our Armenian films as well.
That begs a good question then, Pete. Why an Armenian film festival? What is it about being able to tell your own stories from an Armenian perspective, or just being Armenian involved? Why is that so important?
Well, I think there's a sense in which art has sort of cultural significance, or it can have cultural significance. And I mean, without kind of getting into the discussion about the nebulous definition of culture or even of art, I think you can kind of say broadly that a lot of art is very personal, and a lot of cultural identity is very personal. And so when people say, you know, I made this piece when I was in a particular state of mind, or I made this piece when I was thinking about this particular aspect of myself, like, you're kind of already talking about culture before you even talk about the genre of the film, right? Before you even talk about what the substance and content of the film is, people are already coming from a particular place on the topic. And so there is a sense in which everything we generate is kind of culturally driven. But here, with the Pomegranate Film Festival, we're talking about a very big definition of Armenian culture. There is Armenian culture that I think most people are familiar with, most non-Armenian people are familiar with through the Kardashians, right? Kim Kardashian, the most famous.
They're the ones you jump to right off the bat is...
It's a good touch point for getting people involved, Steve.
Was she at the festival, Peter?
She was not at the festival. But if she made a film that we screened, we'd certainly be happy to have her and her family.
She has made a film, and I hope you didn't screen it at the festival.
But no, we did not screen that at the festival.
I'm not going to. Maybe that may not even make it through editing, but it had to be said.
No, that's one kind of Armenian diaspora that exists in California, and it's become popular through her television program, which I haven't watched a whole lot of, actually. Most Armenians are shocked to hear that. But actually, my non-Armenian girlfriend has watched more of the Kardashians TV show than I have as an Armenian. So
I have no response to that sort of sentence. So, yeah.
I have
no frame of reference.
Well, there are Armenian films being made in the big Armenian diaspora that exists outside of the country of Armenia. And we're talking about people like you and me who live, kind of born and raised in North America. We have, broadly speaking, North American values. We come at things from a North American perspective, which seems like a very broad statement. But when you compare that to the type of films that are being made in Armenia... Armenia being a very homogenous country ethnically, and also something like 95% of people in Armenia identify as Christians in the Armenian Orthodox tradition.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So you're getting a very different type of film being made in Armenia. And then the other, I think to broadly categorize things here, we have the North American and European sort of, Western style films. You have the films coming from Armenia. Then you have another kind of genre of Armenian films coming from Turkey. And so a number of this has a big historical context behind it, which is that a number of Armenians have their roots and find their roots in Turkey that go back to World War I when the Turkish government executed a planned and intentional deliberate genocide against the Armenian population living in Turkey. And for those Armenians who are still either connected to Turkey in some way or continue to live in Turkey, as well as for those Turks in Armenia who are kind of opening up to the idea that their forefathers and their government may have been part of this historical atrocity, there are also a number of interesting films coming from there that come from a different sense of Armenian identity and culture. And so to give you a more concrete idea of what I'm talking about is this. At our festival, we try and include sort of all of these perspectives. And so one of our directors, one of our guests who had come in from Armenia, had mentioned that it's kind of a unique thing to have this festival in Toronto where you can show films about, I guess, more traditional Armenian themes, like our gala movie this year, Roots, which was about, a young man from the U.S. who goes back to Armenia to kind of discover, lo and behold, his roots and kind of discover his Armenianness and what it means to move back to Armenia and kind of have this... forsake the Western values for the more traditional Armenian lifestyle. And we showed that film alongside films that were very subversive of that Armenian lifestyle and culture, which, for instance, Listen to Me, which was a documentary about LGBT Armenians in Armenia.
Oh, wow.
And how difficult it is for them to kind of get along in a majority Christian country that doesn't have the same openness and diversity priorities that we do in the West. And so we can kind of show all of these films, despite the fact that Armenian culture itself is not a monolith. We have this monolithic film festival that is able to kind of reach into different places and show different things. And I think that's one of the bigger values that we offer, and any cultural film festival offers, is that they bring these things together in a way that otherwise they might be very separate.
Well, I think this is one of the things we've seen on a cultural level happening this year. 2017 has been the year that the roof blew off of, whether... Now, I'm not talking about scandals and that, but I'm talking about cultural voice. So you got a film like Get Out, made by Jordan Peele, mm-hmm. which tells a distinctly African-American narrative in many ways, but his voice is important. You wouldn't have Steven Spielberg tell... Get Out. You just wouldn't. But Spielberg can tell, or not that he can't, but he may not have the most personal view on that sort of thing. It's just sort of an outsider's perspective in terms of film. But we see a film like Wonder Woman, directed by Patty Jenkins, the first major superhero franchise, not just telling a story, not just focused on a female character, but having a female director, having that extra added piece of voice to put it in. I mean, it's, you talk about culture. I think culture needs a voice. Culture always has a voice, but whose story is it trying to tell is sort of the question that we've been asking, I think, broadly, mm-hmm. broadly in terms of on a North American level, or even in Hollywood for the last year, specifically in 2017. It's funny, in the Post, one of the lines is that the news is the first rewrite of history, or the first rough draft of history. But I think the arts ultimately can be that first rough draft, or if not the first rough draft, the second draft, you know, trying to get that voice properly out. So it's interesting, I mean, to see here what you're talking about here with the Armenian voice. Because it's not just about, oh, you're Armenian and you're in this movie, so therefore it qualifies and we'll get this movie. What it really sounds like you're talking about is trying to share views on whether it's Armenian culture or an Armenian perspective on non-Armenian culture, as you said as well. Is that fair to say?
That's right. And as you were saying, this is something that I guess is transcendent in film right now, but and goes across the arts. This past year, there was the big hoopla. I think the only word for it is a hoopla, actually.
I'm impressed at your use of the word hoopla.
It was
well
a hoopla.
Done.
There was a hoopla in Canadian literature over, I guess, the status of Aboriginal authors and First Nations voices in Canadian literature. And I think a lot of people said a lot of things they now regret, and we don't need to go through it all again. But the idea that until fairly recently, most of the biggest fictional novels about Aboriginal persons were written by non-Aboriginal people who are not of First Nations. And then people who are trying to, I guess, cash in on Aboriginal First Nations stories and cultural touchstones should non-First Nations people be doing that, right? That discussion, I think, although I think it kind of devolved into a bit of a black and white kind of place, I think in the aftermath of that, a number of people are looking back on it and saying, what we're really concerned about is authenticity.
There it is. That's the word, authenticity.
Yeah. And we want to know that people, it's not just that people aren't being exploited or that their culture isn't being exploited, but that we want to know that our stories that we're receiving in the end are authentic and sincere. And I mean, of course, they're being made for commercial profit. It's not like people are giving away their art for free. And, you know, there is a money trail there that I think is important to the discussion. But ultimately, as the viewer, as the audience, you want to have something that's authentic. And I guess from our perspective at the film festival, we sort of presume authenticity in that way. We're sort of trying to promote our own voices in film through things like our pomegranate, our palm grant is our grant that we give to young and aspiring filmmakers who are kind of working on interesting projects. And we're trying to not just show what artists have been doing, but promote artists in making their dreams come true and or making their artistic projects come true. And so there is a sort of authentic aspect of it that you want to see. And from that perspective, I think any cultural film festival provides a broad audience with a natural and sincere depiction of what's going on within this sort of, you know, compartmentalized community, right? Mm. Most people are not walking around thinking about Armenians in their day-to-day, but when they are going to engage with Armenians, what are they going to engage with, right? And I think a lot of our filmmakers, and I don't want to speak for all of them, but they're coming at it from the perspective that we want to show sort of genuine approach to these issues and bring our cultural touchstones into the conversation on our own terms.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, one of the things I like that you say on your own terms, because I think one of the things we're seeing this year, especially in Hollywood in the last year or two, is finally an access to voice. You know, we're talking about people speaking, being authentic, but, you know, people being invited to speak from their own perspective and voice with diversity is something truly unique. And I think very special about this moment. I mean, they've got a long way to go, long, long way to go. But I think we're seeing more attempts to speak with authenticity moving forward, or at least trying to get there a little bit further. Like you said, there's always that issue of who's paying of money you know, Disney is known for his four quadrant, you know, crowd pleasing films and all that stuff. And I'm not even criticizing those. What I'm saying is, who's telling the stories? It matters. Mm-hmm. It matters. And I think it's fair to be recognizing those things.
And who's telling the story and who are they telling it to and why, right?
Mm.
I think there's a fair amount of cynicism about politicized artistic endeavors recently, and even as you're referencing sort of the politics of a voice, right? If you have a strong voice and people are listening to you, should they believe you? And what kind of credibility do you need to bring in order for somebody to believe you? It's the same with art. It's the same with any kind of artistic project. You need to be at least somewhat credible in your presentation, mm-hmm. Particularly in documentary of, I mean, things like genocide. You need to bring some credibility to the table with you. And that may not simply be, well, I'm Armenian and therefore what yeah. I'm saying needs to be believed. There may need to be more than that. And for some people, it's more important that you have the opportunity to speak than to necessarily have the everybody believe you. And this has been a major problem in Armenian filmmaking. In fact, one of the documentaries that we showed this year, Intent to Destroy, very powerful documentary by Joe Berlinger, documenting specifically the attempts that the Turkish government has made to de-emphasize or, in fact, not acknowledge in any way that genocide had happened against Armenians. And in that film, he discusses how we're talking like almost 100 years ago, like in early Hollywood, there were attempts made to make films about a film particularly called The 40 Days of Musadag about the Armenian genocide. And how the Turkish government had a lobby group that essentially put a stop to it.
Hmm.
And so this film festival is not, we don't take for granted the fact that we are able to have Armenian filmmakers and Armenian stories being told. It is something that we've had to overcome in no small way. And I think today, I mean, to this day, even again in that documentary, another Armenian film by Canadian Atva Megoyan, Ararat, faced similar pressures, and after it was released, which I think was a little more inevitable in that time, about 15 years ago when it was released, after it was released, a book was released that tried to debunk it.
Oh,
and
really?
It was Ararat and all the lies in it.
Oh, wow.
About the genocide. And all the reasons why this movie should be written off and the facts in it about the genocide should be written off. And so even to this day, the pressure continues to exist from, you know, the Turkish government and other stakeholders in genocide about what films should be made and what shouldn't, and which ones should succeed and which shouldn't. The Promise.
From Ralph Winter.
Last year, yeah. That, there is a big hoopla. A big hoopla.
Oh, no, not another hoopla.
Another hoopla. There was a big hoopla about that film as well. Because
as long as it didn't lead to a kerfuffle.
That's well, it did lead to a kerfuffle.
Oh, my gosh.
Because after it premiered in a theater that had limited seating, the amount of downvotes it had on IMDb were something like 10 times as many as seats in the theater.
What?
And so people were rating it with having not seen it, right?
Wow.
And the people who were doing that were people who were like the substance of the movie of The Promise, which is, again, about the Armenian genocide. This, you know, it's fake news, and it shouldn't be out there.
Wow.
Fake news, to use popular parlance.
Never heard that before, actually. That,
oh, yeah.
Fake news.
You must not read any news.
I sit in my basement and watch movies.
That's the right way to live.
There it is. No, it is not. My children haven't seen me in months.
Oh.
No.
Oh.
Sorry, the kerfuffle. Back to the kerfuffle.
The kerfuffle, I think, highlighted the how some of these things can be politicized. And when a particular voice that was silenced for quite some time is able to finally say and have the platform to say what they've been trying to say for years, for decades, there will always be sort of this political force against the film.
Wow.
And that continues. It's something that we've luckily, as the Pomegranate Film Festival has been blessed with, not having to deal with a lot of that kind of politicized opposition to our screenings, thankfully. But we know that a lot of our artists are putting up with that. And, I mean, that's something that's happening in 2017, right? There's still opposition to sincerely and authentically made films about important issues.
That's so true. It's so true. And actually, Pete, we do have one of those, one of your directors and artists. We have an interview with him. His name is Hike Matavosian, and his film is called The Passenger, that screened at the Palm Fest this past, last month, really, in November. And we had a chance to sit down with Hike, and here's what he had to say. We're very excited this week to be here at the Pomegranate Film Festival, and we are talking with Hike Matavosian. He is the director of The Passenger, which is a short film entered here in the festival. Welcome, Hike. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks a lot for the interview.
Oh, I'm glad you could see it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about The Passenger? Where'd you get the idea?
Well, initial idea came from a newspaper article. Mm-hmm. So it's based on a true story. It is about a cab driver who picks up this passenger, and she offers $100,000 to murder somebody. Mm-hmm. And in the end, we find out it is her who wants to get murdered. Mm-hmm. It is a story about karma and how you will never escape your sins.
That's fascinating. What do you mean by you'll never escape your sins and it's about karma? Can you expand on that a little bit? That's
well,
a really interesting statement about it.
Yeah, what I'm trying to say is it is loosely based on Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment.
Wow.
Whereas the main character, Raskolnikov, makes a crime, then he has a inner guilt. Mm-hmm. Instead of having an external punishment, he has a punishment inside of himself. Mm-hmm. He feels guilt, and eventually he turns himself into the police. The same thing happens in my short story, where my main character, the cab driver, eventually feeling the guilt inside of him, turns himself to the police.
Mm. You mentioned this is a short film. It's only 12 minutes long, I think you were telling me before. Why did you choose to make it just a short? Why not a longer version? Why not tell it for 80 minutes or more? In all seriousness, I know we were laughing about that before, but...
Well, there are times when there are short films that are perfect for 12 or 15 minutes, but when you extend it, it becomes ridiculous or doesn't work, because sometimes short form can work perfectly for a certain... stories. So I think for this story, especially this story has a twist in the end, it works perfectly within 12-14 minute range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's fair. Could you tell me a little bit about the responsibility you feel as a filmmaker? Because that was something else that, you know, as we were dialoguing, you expressed pretty strongly, is that there's a responsibility you feel.
Yeah, it's interesting that sometimes I compare a filmmaker to being a prophet or a monk or a priest, because as a filmmaker or as an artist, we all have a responsibility towards the audience or towards the people who are watching our films, because we're trying to convey something. We're trying to convey a story. We're trying to convey some sort of an inspiration to the audience. So I think I feel a responsibility towards my audience, and I take seriously every story I tell, because I feel like art itself has a power. Has a power to transform, or has a power to affect negatively towards the audience. So who am I? As an artist, I try to positively affect the audience, almost like a priest tries to tell a story of a Bible to affect positively the people who listen to them.
Well, it sounds like, you know, when you talk about it, that you, when, the way that you're talking about film, it almost sounds like you consider it a spiritual experience to not only hear stories but tell them as well.
Absolutely. I think art and filmmaking is a spiritual form. Watching films, watching great films, is almost like a prayer. Is almost like a spiritual experience. Is a catharsis. For example, Tree of Life for me was a cathartic moment watching that movie. So absolutely, I think filmmaking and art is a very spiritual
experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned Tree of Life, which I love that film. I absolutely love that. I was wondering,
Why was that so powerful for you? What was it about it?
I think Tree of Life was an absolute perfect moment for me as an audience, and at the same time as a filmmaker. Watching that film was a spiritual experience. Why? I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to put it into words, but it was a total spiritual experience. It was like a prayer. I was watching images conveying some sort of a religious and spiritual experience to me as an audience member, and that's what art is about.
Now, you had mentioned that you were being mentored by, his name escapes me.
Yeah. I'm being mentored by Mardik Martin, who was a classmate of Martin Scorsese, and he wrote such screenplays as Mean Streets, Raging Bull, New York, New York. So I've been mentored by him for the past 3 years.
Mm. What is it about your relationship with Mardik that is shaped your vision for storytelling the most, would you say?
I've learned a lot from him. He's a master. I've learned a lot both about screenwriting and about life. Mm. The main point that I've learned from him is you gotta take everything from reality and add some imagination to it. Mm. So you combine reality, real characters, real stories, and you add some imagination, and you come up with a magic.
Mm. Wow, that's really interesting. I got to think about that one for a minute. Do those two things work hand in hand, or do you think that one is more dominant than the other? Because it sounds like you take reality and add the magic, but is it more magic than reality? Is it just the relationship between the two?
It's, in his words, I would say that for him, those two are similar. Mm. I think magic, imagination, and reality are similar. Mm. He says that without reality, you wouldn't have this magic. Mm. Without magic, you wouldn't have reality. So you have to combine these two to create the best possible screenplay, the best possible story. And also, I want to add to this that in my movies or my stories, I try to concentrate on human beings. Mm. For me, the most important concept, the most important center of my stories is a human being, a person.
In what way?
Well, this is what I think. Every person has obsessions, has fears, has hatred, has love. Mm. And I think it's a universal emotion. Mm. Everyone feels those things, no matter what race, what color, what religion you believe in. Mm. You love the same way, you fear the same way, and you hate the same way. Mm. We all are, in a way, prisoners of our own basic instincts. Mm. Humanity, in my opinion, hasn't changed. I think the technological advancements hasn't added up to our spiritual enhancement. Mm. I think, in a way, the technology and the social media added to our spiritual abyss. And I think as a humanity, as a modern humanity, we need more spiritual freedom and spiritual connection with each other. I don't even know how to
continue. No, that's powerful stuff. You know, it's funny you talk about social media. And when you and I were chatting before, you mentioned, or we had talked about how the fact that use of things like Instagram and that has made us all sort of filmmakers, and we sort of construct our own story. How do you think that affects us as humanity in that reality?
Yeah, that's social media is a interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
Because you see people posting only the best side of themselves. Mm. You see the pretty pictures, the fun they're having, all the great experiences in their life, but they never post an anxieties, depression, an ugly pictures. Mm. So in a way, it's a narration of their perfect life, which is not really perfect. They're trying to imitate something. They're trying to fake themselves in thinking that their life is perfect. And by getting likes, they're trying to prove themselves that they're beautiful, that they're happy.
Yeah.
it's an interesting phenomenon that I think is making our society less happy, more depressed.
Well, it's interesting because we're so connected, but we're so isolated at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. There is some sort of a great thing in technology and social media. At the same time, there is an evil in it. We're trying to isolate ourselves, but we're believing in connection.
Hmm. Wow. You're right. You're absolutely right. As a filmmaker, and you've made multiple films and music videos and whatnot, who is other than, of course, your relationship with Matic, is there any other key influences that you would say that you look to, whether or not you know them personally, but just influences on how you make?
This is the thing. For me, there is only two distinction. Mm-hmm. I don't have a distinction between Hollywood, independent, or art house cinema. There is two distinction: good movies and bad movies. Hmm. Doesn't matter if it's a Hollywood movie or an independent cinema.
What's the dividing line? What makes it? I'm going to throw it to you. What makes a good movie and what makes a bad movie?
Man, that's a tough question.
You loaded that gun, so oh here my, it comes.
Damn it. That's a fucking tough question. Oh, my God. Oh, what makes a good movie? I honestly don't know. Like, literally, there are emotions, there are stories, there are characters that you connect with, that you relate with. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of aspects that makes a movie a good movie. Mm-hmm. or a bad movie. But I'd rather watch a bad movie that is entertaining or a bad art house movie that doesn't have any entertainment at all.
Okay.
It's just bad.
Yeah. So you'd rather watch something that with no redeeming value whatsoever.
But at least it's entertaining.
At least it's entertaining. All right, very
well. But then if you have an art house movie that is both boring and doesn't have anything to convey, but it comes off as an art house cinema.
Right.
You know, but
you just described the Sharknado effect, is what it's called. Not to point any fingers, but I'm just saying.
For me, look, this is the thing. For me, the purest art form is music.
That's right. Yes, you were saying that. Yeah. Why?
Why? Because I think that music has nothing to do with reality. Mm. But in a way, it resonates to our souls because it's just the vibrations in the air that could touch ourselves and almost makes us feel connected to God. Mm. Cinema, in a way, is a combination of all the art forms you could have. And we try to have that mixture. And cinema is this new art form. That's why I feel like cinema has a lot to grow.
Mm. Yeah, I'll start wrapping up.
A lot.
Thanks so much, Heike. Really, it was great to chat with you. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You know, you made me think. You made me think. Thanks a lot.
Phew. Well, that was my goal. So anyway, no. thanks so much. And the passenger, can it be found anywhere? Is it online or just?
It will be online right after the festival run. It has been in 9 film festivals in 9 different countries, and it's still going strong.
Wow.
So hopefully by the winter, I'll have it online.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, man.
Hey.
Thanks so much for speaking with us, Heike. That was really appreciated. And actually, I'm going to have you back on the podcast again soon. It's such a great conversation. Looking forward to that.
Let me just say that Heike is one of my favorite people who attends the festival. He was also at the festival in 2016 for his short film Syria, My Love, which was, I guess, kind of documenting some of the issues about the migration crisis that was happening and the people who stayed behind in Syria. And his stuff is really powerful, and he's just such a cool guy to hang out with, as you guys heard.
You know, Peter, one of the things we were talking about, documentaries and that about genocide and the films, certainly every film has a perspective, as we've been talking about already in giving voice. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the issue of violence. Here's the quote that you want people to remember. Violence is a funny thing. In films, and especially, we watched one of the films that you, so it was the 15th anniversary of Ararat.
That's right.
With Atma Goyan, who was present at the fest.
Yes, and his wife, Arsina Khanjan, who is one of the main actresses in the film.
Yes, so they were there at the festival, and I mean, the film's fairly graphic. I guess the question I would have for you in a case like that is, how far is too far? You know, in telling a story, we talk about giving people voice, but are there limitations to that? What do you think about that issue?
Well, this sort of plays into a broader question of violence in media generally. I mean, it's hard to talk about violence in media without talking about something like Game of Thrones, where you've got on a television program unprecedented amount of violence and sexuality that that crosses a lot of the borders.
Less sexuality now, all right. They've toned it down.
They've toned it down.
After the actresses revolted. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but the violence is what people are always talking up, about, yeah. Right? That's what people are talking about, and some people love it because it's violent, and some people are, like, watching it in spite of the violence, and other people are not watching it at all because they don't want to see any violence of that kind, right? And so in a fictional film such as Ararat, which for those of you who haven't seen it, it'll be a spoiler-free description here, but it's a film about a film being made about the genocide. So the guys in the film are making a film about the true events of 1915.
But it's not a documentary.
It's
a fictional film about a film.
Yes, a fictional film about a fictional film. And the guys are making the film based on the journals of Dr. Clarence Usher, who was an American missionary doctor working in Armenia, in Turkey, at the time of the genocide. And so it's based on a true story, and they're kind of recounting the events that happen in it. And as they're recounting those events, they depict some of them, which, as you can imagine, during a genocide, were particularly graphic. And I guess... for Ararat, I don't think people walk away from that movie feeling like it's an overly violent film. It doesn't leave you with that impression. The impression I think it leaves you with is a more is a story about how we think about the genocide and how we depict the genocide and the pain that it's left in the people who carry on, the Armenians who have roots and connections to it. It's not really about the horrors of the genocide, but it does touch on them. Two scenes that stand out to me, a particularly graphic and troubling rape scene, and another scene where a group of women are being sexually tormented and tortured by Turkish male officers. Now, again, these are based on real accounts and on personal stories. It's hard to discount the veracity of the truth of them. But the question really is, to what extent do we need to depict those?
Yeah, I it's interesting you say that, because so many films seem to walk that tightrope. You know, it's there is this boundary. There seems to be a boundary of acceptable versus unacceptable in terms of violence. And it's such a scope. You know, how do you use violence to horrify and remind people of the greater events? Like, for example, that rape scene, when we saw it, it is horrifying, but it's meant to horrify. Like, you're supposed to be uncomfortable and squeamish and bothering you, which is why the inclusion of her daughter is there in some ways, because there are some who would not be as horrified. And I'm not saying things or anything, but by adding the child in, you add that extra level of disgust and wretchedness to it, right? But you look at so many films out there, and I don't know, it's there's a balance between the glorification of violence and violence to drive home your point, to violence just for the sake of violence. There's quite a spectrum. There's quite a spectrum in that. And you see a film like Schindler's List, you know, back in the day, and I guess that movie's 25 years old now. But you see these people in the gas chamber, these women in the gas chamber, and they're naked. It is the least sexiest scene of all time, with nudity and all that stuff. And it's horrific. And you would say, well, I didn't need to see that. But in some ways, what it does is it drives home the reality of the horror. But then you've got guys, you know, you've got the other end of the spectrum where people are just throwing violence in. You've got torture porn. There was a few years back, there was that the height of the fad of torture porn with films like The Hills Have Eyes and Hostel and all those things that came out. And they were deliberately trying to go as gross as possible, not to make people go, oh, that's horrible, how could they do that, to, oh, that's so cool, I can't believe they did that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So where's the line? Where's the boundary? When do things become too much?
Well, I'll tell you what that line is right after these messages.
Hi. I'm the most interesting man in the...
No, I don't know what that line is, which is why I was stalling there. I don't know what that line is. I don't know that anybody could tell you what that line is, but we have a problem... And we try and solve it with, I guess, standards, right? The problem is what you described, in that some people don't want to see it, but it's true and it needs to be shown in that sense, right? So we come up with sort of ethical standards in order to go around those things. When I say we, I mean people like journalists, right? They have their own code of ethics. Photojournalists in particular get in trouble for this all the time when they're documenting real-life horrors that are happening in front of their eyes. To what extent are they getting involved in alleviating the pain or the horror? And so there are also standards for television, what can be shown and what can't be shown and at what times they can be shown.
Oh, yeah, there's the 9 o'clock, the 9 o'clock barrier, right, as they say.
And then it's the same for films that are being made in Hollywood and other sort of mainstream production companies that are making films. They all have their own set of standards. They're all written down. You can probably find them if you Google them. And they're all different. Some of it's based on commercialization, and some of it's based on a more sort of sense of morality and human dignity. But when it comes to something like the Armenian genocide, I think that reasonable minds can disagree over how much needs to be shown or how much should be shown. There's no question that the events of genocide, if they were to be shown in their full, unfiltered version, could and should make any one of us sick. And the level of horror could not even be adequately translated onto screen. It's the kind of thing that goes beyond even the physical violence and the physical pain, but also into a realm of hatred, and into a realm of dehumanization, and also, I guess, pain for people who are survivors, and a sort of guilt. That psychologists kind of explain as survivor guilt, where people who have survived these atrocities and didn't die, say, in the gas chambers in Nazi Germany and in concentration camps, they have their own perception of what happened, and it's, for a lot of them, to the point of inarticulable, right? Difficult for them to even comprehend what happened to themselves, let alone for an audience member to comprehend what happens, you know, from a completely external viewpoint. So we're juggling a lot of these types of things, and the products that we end up with are either ones where we have shocking images that really sicken us, or slightly shocking images that don't sicken us enough. The question I was going to ask you is, in your experience with these films, I guess, what's your personal threshold? And what do you find compelling, and what do you find being overboard?
I think a lot of it comes down to intent. And I think that, you know, it's funny, Game of Thrones doesn't particularly bother me on a violence level, just for sheer fact of, well, I'll be honest, desensitization. Mm-hmm. But the violence there is totally glorified. Like, it's meant for you to say, did you see how cool that was? Yeah. You know, it's designed that way.
Yeah.
I have a higher tolerance, I find, in a film like Private Ryan, Saving Private Ryan in 98, for example, shows you the horror of World War II, and... It's not that, and I may turn away if something gets too graphic, but I have a higher appreciation for the fact that it needs to be in there because the movie is trying to communicate something of value. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a fan of Tarantino, not to pick on Tarantino. I'm not a fan of his work generally, and it's because I don't love the slice and dice blood splatter that's supposed to, you know, with fanboy rock music in the background. I'm just not a, that's not my thing. Mm-hmm. Horror movies and that, I just don't understand, because in general, the purpose of that is to help you feel afraid, and it's like you're paying money, so it's cool to be feeling afraid in those things. That's my personal threshold. Mm-hmm. But then you've got a film, you know, looking at The Passion of the Christ, and this is not just because I'm a pastor, and it's not because of all that stuff, but I mean, in Passion of the Christ, for example, it is a graphic film. Mm-hmm. Like, holy crap, when that movie was over, I just sat in silence, because they had to show you the 30 lashes. Here they are, one by one, and you had to see the agony. Mm-hmm. And people complained, and they said, oh, why is it so violent? Because, hello, it's a reminder of the viciousness of the violence. And sometimes the gloves have to come off. Mm-hmm. I really believe that. If you're trying to communicate a point, not just for, like, man, that's cool, but for you have to understand that the reality of this, there's some ways you have to do it. And it's I support that. Mm-hmm. You know, if all you do when you go to see a horror movie – or not, sorry – if all you do when you see a war movie is you hear bang, bang, and a guy hiding behind a trench, and you want to display the horrors of war, mm-hmm. but you don't actually show anything horrific, how are you going to get there? Mm-hmm. The Bible's a violent book. The Bible's extremely violent.
Absolutely.
I had a conversation with this not long ago, and it's sort of like the Bible in many ways is violent in a number of ways, or is graphic in a number of ways. But you don't see it. And in our particular culture, the visual is what stimulates the most, right? So, you know, so you read a story of an arm ripped off and smashed a guy's skull in or something like that. But if you don't see it in a visual culture, it just sort of, you imagine it the way you want to imagine it, and it's fine. But you're not, it doesn't necessarily leave you horrified.
Mm-hmm. Even the crucifixion has a sanitized
way
of communicating it, right?
Yeah. And, that's why I liked Passion, is because they said, okay, we're going to talk about the crucifixion, but all this, you know, you're not getting the Sunday morning special on this. You're getting, this is, you want to see what it looked like? Here.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
The one thing I think about, actually, I hadn't thought about the Passion of the Christ when we started this discussion, and it brings it back to the topic of genocide, is that why is the violence happening from the perspective of the person who's doing the violence, right?
Hmm.
When you're in church and you sing about, you know, the nails in your hands and the nails in your feet show you how much you love me, you're not thinking about the people who are driving the nails into Jesus, right? You're thinking about why Jesus died, but not about why the people killed him, right? Yeah. And when you see the Passion of the Christ, that is what is shocking as well, is that the violence is not happening because Jesus loves you. The violence is happening because people hate Jesus.
Yeah.
And maybe it's happening because the soldier is just doing his job and he doesn't, you know, he's like,
the
empire pays me to do this. But the crowd hates him, right? Like, that's...
I'm sorry, I just thought Star Wars. Anyway,
Well,
that's how I feel when Vader kills. Anyway,
now that you've laughed about the crucifixion,
I'm a pastor and I work at the bottom.
in the genocide documentary context, or even in fiction as well, the person who's perpetrating the violence is doing it out of a place of hatred and dehumanization. It's dehumanization of that person, that individual in front of them.
Absolutely.
But then the entire culture, the entire religion, whatever the genocide is predicated on, it takes on something bigger than the human toll. That's another dangerous area where you can focus a little too much on the cultural destruction and not enough on the human destruction. And that's another balance that I think a lot of our artists have to ride. But you see the hatred and why it's being perpetrated, and that, I think, informs our view of the violence, like you were saying about Tarantino. It's not about hatred. It's about the glorification of violence. That's so cool. I don't think anybody looks at a genocide documentary or anybody makes a genocide documentary, I should say, and is like, man, I want to show how cool this violence is. They're depicting hate. And so because they're depicting hate, my tolerance is informed by that. And, I mean, myself personally, I think this is idiosyncratic and totally subjective for everyone, but I don't have a high tolerance for violence. But like you said, a lot of people are extremely desensitized to violence.
Yeah.
And while I would consider myself desensitized, I also consider myself to be as I get older in particular, I don't know why this is. Maybe somebody can explain it to me, but I have less and less of a tolerance for violence. I think because maybe I'm just growing into the reality of it all. But when I was a kid, it didn't seem to bug me. Now it really does.
Well, I think growing into the reality of it all is pretty accurate because you've seen more and you understand the ramifications of these things. You know, like you understand the horrors of war in a deeper way. When you're younger, you don't. I mean, it's not that you don't understand it, because I know lots of young people that are more versed in social justice even than I am at my age. But the way you view the world is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes total sense. I think that it's fair. I think you can immediately tell what the intent of a scene is supposed to do. Like there's a moment in the new Star Wars movie where a guy gets a lightsaber through the head. And I'm not going to lie, I clapped. It was like, Now there's no blood splatter and all that, but it's like, dude, they just lightsabered his face.
Yeah.
And
it was a cool scene.
It was cool, but it's not. The intent of that scene is not to horrify. That moment is, you're supposed to be cheering. You talk about perspective. Yeah. You're cheering for the guys who are wielding the lightsabers to accomplish their mission.
And the victim is a guy in a red hood who is like...
He's a faceless nobody. Yeah, he's no one. It's a very different intent.
Oh, yeah.
However, when you can immediately tell the difference between that and something that is intended to remind you that reality has horrific moments.
And I'll say this too, is that with film, especially with a film that you know that your friends are watching too, and your people in your community, you know, your cultural community are watching, you're actually watching it together, right?
Yeah.
And you're digesting this horror together, which I think adds a different dimension to it, because, you know, I don't know that Quentin Tarantino's movies, generally speaking, are, you know, significant for a particular cultural group, right? And if they are, maybe people are very divided.
It is. It's called fanboys.
Yeah, yeah. but not to a particular ethnic or religious group, let's say, right?
Right.
With the Armenian Genocide documentaries, this is the kind of thing that people are digesting and working through together. And they have conversations about... far more naturally than fanboys do on Reddit. These are people who are getting together at the community center talking about the news of the day, as well as the new film that was put out about their people and their you know, parents and grandparents' struggle.
Hmm.
They get to digest it and talk about it together and talk about things like hatred and abject violence and the toll it takes on their ethnicity, the toll it takes on their religious, you know... Their religious point of view and how it informs their religious point of view or how it defines their ethnicity. Film, I think, is unique in that you can watch it with somebody sitting beside you, right?
Hmm.
You can't read a book quite the same way.
That'd be a really interesting experience, actually.
Well, people do read books out loud to each other. That's fine. But, I mean, I'm talking about the typical way we digest film is... Right. Is in community, in a theater.
Yeah, you're right.
Or at home, and then people are talking about it at the water cooler, right? The violence in genocide films, whether you're comfortable with it or not, I think is a discussion piece in and of itself. And it leads you to talk about how you feel about what actually happened. It's actually a door opener for a conversation about something very real, which is, how do I feel about... the violence they enacted against us, and would I do it against them if I had the chance? Right. Mm. I mean, that's a difficult question. You hate the people on the screen who are doing this, but if you were in that position, would you hate the person who was doing it to you, or would you have a moral higher ground? I mean, those are the kind of difficult questions I think are prompted often by genocide documentaries about the Armenian genocide, about the Holocaust, about things that are going on today. We need to think about what we would do in that position as a victim and what we would do in that position if we were asked to be the victimizer. That, I think, is one of the more powerful aspects, or what the potential of violence in genocide documentaries is turning the microphone back to you, the audience. What would you say? What would you do?
Mic drop. That's good.
I don't want to ruin your nice mic, so I won't drop it.
Please don't touch my mic. No, that's a great place to start to wrap up, because I think you're absolutely right, Pete. And it's a delicate question. It's a delicate question. But I'm so glad that the Palm Festival gives people the opportunity to share and speak and share their voice. How can people connect with it and you?
Well, feel free to check out the pomegranatefilmfestival.com. This is where we put the Facebook button and the Instagram button. We are on Facebook and Instagram. Our next screenings are currently slated for May, which will be the 100th anniversary of the Republic of Armenia, the First Republic. We have not announced what films we'll be showing, but they will be shown in Toronto, in the North York area. And did I mention we were based out of Toronto? I didn't mention that off the top, but we are based out of Toronto, and we will be screening some films in May, and then gearing up again from there for the big festival taking place in November. Keep an eye on our website. You can sign up for our mailing list, which is the easiest way to figure out what's going on and when we will be screening things and the big announcements that happen. Facebook and Instagram will also be doing that as well.
Cool. Very cool. And a special thanks to Hike for coming on. Hopefully we'll get a chance to speak with you soon. Thank you so much, Pete. This has been great. Love chatting with you.
Thank you, Steve.
And for you at home, a reminder that you can find us on SoundCloud, Podomatic, iTunes, and, of course, the website, screenfish.net. Oh, and Stitcher. And if you go to screenfish.net, you can download Fishing for More, and which are questions, small group questions that you can ask if you're talking about this film. In fact, I might leave this part of the conversation out because we're not talking about a film. But anyway, also a reminder that Screenfish is nonprofit. So if you're as excited about what's going on through the site as we are, you can, and you're from Canada, you can make donations that are tax receivable to Screenfish. The link will be on the podcast page. For more information, you can easily check that out on the website. And as always, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.